When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
This episode is brought to you by Audible, the audiobook service with more than 180,000 titles to choose from. Get a free audiobook and a 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/game.
This week on Retronauts...
Ghostbusters!
This episode of Retronauts is brought to you by Casper Mattress. Named one of Time's best inventions of 2015, the Casper is one of the most awarded mattresses of the decade. How did it achieve this feat? Well, it takes the form of a mattress that combines both premium memory foam with latex foam. That's right, never again will you have to drive home from the mattress store weeping, wondering what your life would be like with a different kind of foam. And if that isn't enough, the sheer convenience of buying a Casper mattress makes it the best possible choice. Casper offers free delivery and returns within a 100-day period. Folks, just try to lay on a mattress in a store for more than 10 minutes without being asked to leave. And not politely, might I add. And as a special bonus, all Retronauts listeners can get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting caspertrial.com/game and using the promo code 50SLEEP. That's the numbers 5, then 0, and then the word sleep with a capital S. And remember, as always, terms and conditions do apply.
Dell Gaming creates machines to make every experience more intense and real. From powerful Dell Gaming PCs with Intel Core processors to the ultimate Alienware VR-ready experience, there's a PC designed to bring your best game at every level. Because the best feature of a gaming machine is the power to make you forget it's there. Don't just play, game. Visit Dell.com/gaming to learn more. That's Dell.com/gaming.
We now return to the real Ghostbusters.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Retronauts. I am your host for this one, Bob Mackey, and today's topic is Ghostbusters games. Before I go more into that, who is here with me today across the table, as usual, is...
Jeremy Parrish, the Winston Zeddemore of Retronauts.
Wow. That means you joined late and we disrespect you in every way.
I'm the token minority, the token old guy.
I guess that's true. Who else is here next to Jeremy?
Michael Raparez. I guess I'd sort of be like one of the extreme Ghostbusters that only shows up every once in a while, maybe the guy in the wheelchair.
Okay. I'm not familiar with that. And actually, we will not be talking about the extreme Ghostbusters because they are not canon.
Are those like the new monkeys?
Sort of.
Yeah, they're the very ugly late 90s cartoon characters.
They're the Batman Beyond of Ghostbusters.
Batman Beyond was much better than that.
But, I think people like Batman Beyond, yeah. So that's not a good
comparison. That's true.
I don't think there's any fondness. If you've got fondness for extreme Ghostbusters, write us a letter and then put it in the garbage. And who else is here with us today?
Kat Bailey, the token lady that the Ghostbusters have to save.
That's right. And
but Ghostbusters is all ladies now.
Kat, oh, yeah.
I've got to tell you, I've read several Breitbart articles that told me that men are more biologically prepared to be Ghostbusters. Science is true in this case. Mm.
And we're going to talk about none of that because that was a joke.
Actually, Steve Bannon looks just like Slimer, so I'm willing to believe it.
Jeremy, Slimer keeps that shit together. He works out. He eats an entire hot dog cart, but he knows when to stop. That's all I'm saying. So today's episode is all about Ghostbusters games, and there's a reason I'm doing this because it's a very special episode for me because a Ghostbusters game episode was my first episode of Retronauts. It was episode 72, which was strangely enough Ghostbusters and Majora's Mask. I don't know where that pairing came from.
Bob. Could it be a Bob Mackie pairing?
Let us summon Bob from the Ouija board.
They needed to get that Bob Mackie magic onto Retronauts, and some listeners have regretted it ever since. But yeah, it was a weird episode for me. I loved being on it, but it was a call-in episode, and I remember being in my tiny grad school office, which was literally half the size of this recording studio, if you can believe it. It was basically like a desk and a chair and bookcases that threatened to crush me at every moment. But I remember calling in and being extremely nervous, having so many notes in front of me, and I've never stopped being nervous, and I've never stopped having notes in front of me on Retronauts. So yeah, that's the history. That's still online. People always ask me, and all of our one-up episodes that we don't own are all on archive.org. Just type in Retronauts, and you'll find all 200-plus of them, and you can look that one up. It's episode 72.
Thank you, Jason
and,
Chen.
Yes, exactly. Who did it?
Jason Chen's just like a guy who does a lot of archive.
Okay, great.
Archive.org.
And that was him who did it, or
no? Probably not.
Okay,
whoever did it, put it up there.
Thank you so much.
Somebody also archived Act of Time Babel, which was the RPG companion podcast to Retronauts. Becca went up, and Bob, I think the first time we ever talked was when you called in to Act of Time Babel to talk about Resonance of Fate.
That's right, and I think Final Fantasy 13 as well. So yeah, all my first ones were call-ins for some reason. That was the call-in era of One Up. I'm not sure what the initiative was there, but. We don't let anyone call us here because we don't want to hear your opinions. You'll hear ours.
We literally had a phone on the wall that we would answer and pipe into the podcast.
That's weird. That's very strange.
All very analog.
Yeah. But we're going to be talking about Ghostbusters games, and I feel like depending on how old you are, the Ghostbusters entered your life in a different way. So I wanted to ask everybody before we start, when did you find the Ghostbusters? When did they enter your life? And let's start with Jeremy because I feel like Jeremy might have been the most age-appropriate for the first Ghostbusters movie. When did you get into Ghostbusters? Did you get into Ghostbusters?
Yeah, so I found Ghostbusters when these two guys came to my house. They were wearing suits and they had bicycles and they said, have you heard the good news about the holy – oh, wait. No, that's a different kind of ghost. Never mind. No, I actually –
Would you let us slime you, brother?
I feel like I saw Ghostbusters in the theater during its initial run.
You would have been like 10 probably?
Yeah, maybe. No, you know, I don't think I saw it in theaters, but I think, you know, it made the rounds on VHS shortly after. So I had seen it by the time I entered junior high school. So that was 1987 because I'm old. So yeah, I definitely saw it in its initial foray into the public consciousness before the cartoon.
Were you on board with that immediately or did you love it? Did you fall in love with it?
I thought it was funny and cool and there was a giant marshmallow guy and I didn't get any of the sexual jokes whatsoever.
There's a lot of them in that
there
movie.
Are.
Oh, yeah.
Watching it as an adult, I realized that.
I think as a kid I was kind of aware that, you know, the ghost blowjob, I was like, that's inappropriate.
Yeah.
But I didn't totally get it, I don't think.
Yeah. I mean, did you follow the Ghostbusters, the cartoon, to Ghostbusters 2?
I saw Ghostbusters 2 in the theater and we all agreed, wow, that was really bad. And I did see some of the cartoon occasionally, but I was kind of too old by that point to see the cartoon. So I, you know, am peripherally aware of it but didn't really watch that much of it. I was baffled by Egon's hairstyle.
I loved it. Oh, man.
No, that was
like
best.
That doesn't look anything like he does in the TV and in the movie.
We'll talk more about it, but like stuff like that that's secretly anime, I think that was what sparked my love of anime. I was just like, I want all cartoons to look like this, and why do certain ones look like this? And then I discovered later in life. Michael, how about you? What about Ghostbusters? When did you start to like it, if you did like it, and how did you follow it through the course of its life?
I was kind of only dimly aware of the movie when it came out, but got really into it when the real Ghostbusters came out because as a kid I was like super into not just ghost stories but like reading books on hauntings and stuff like that, like quote unquote real life ghosts. And so like this cartoon about paranormal investigators just sort of dovetailed with my own interests at the time, and I got obsessively into Ghostbusters to the point where like I was buying – all the toys. I had the Firehouse for a long time, which I just recently sold on eBay.
A friend of mine had the Firehouse.
Did you sell it to buy the Lego Firehouse?
No, I sold it because it's huge and I needed it out
that
of my
thing
life.
Was like $100 and it was the holy grail of many a child.
Yeah,
I sold it for like $150, so profit.
As a slightly poor kid at that point, I was just like envious of any child who had the Firehouse, any child who had the proton pack with the piece of foam attached to it.
I had that. I also made one before then, like with scrap wood in my dad's garage.
That's amazing. Did you have a trap though?
No. I did have friends who went and made the traps and who got the trap toy. But yeah, I was like – I had a few friends who were into it and then like within a few months I think I was the only one who was into it. So I started getting made fun of constantly.
Oh, man.
Wow. Went cool bad that fast, huh?
Yeah. Well, to the point where like anytime I had anything Ghostbusters related, like there are these bully kids who would come up and go like, oh, Ghostbusters, and then like – razz me about
it. Well, you know, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, like times change fast, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That comes at you fast. You know, now that I think about it, the main reason I didn't watch the Ghostbusters cartoon wasn't age. It was because I was really distracted by the fact that Peter Venkman sounded exactly like Garfield.
Oh, man. Yeah. I prefer we'll talk about it, but I prefer Lorenzo Music's version of Peter Venkman to Dave Coulier doing Bill Murray in Caddyshack, basically. Yeah, sure. That's basically how they changed it. But
let's not even talk about the Slimer and the real Ghostbusters era.
I think we have to, Michael. But how about
in
your
quality terms? That's going to be comparable to most of the games that appear this.
Pretty
this
much,
episode.
Pretty much. How about the movies? How do you feel? Did you find those after the cartoon?
Yeah,
or?
I did. After I think like a season or two of the cartoon, I finally watched the movie. My parents wouldn't let me watch it beforehand because of the sex jokes.
Oh,
but,
okay.
Then I was like, why doesn't the movie have this much swearing? Also, why does Peter look like Ray and Ray look like Peter?
Yeah, interesting. That's a weird take.
It is.
But I had a similar take. But Kat, how did you find the Ghostbusters?
As far as I've known, I've always liked the Ghostbusters as long as I can remember because I've been watching – I watched the cartoon from like one of my earliest memories and I really loved it. I adored it. And one day my parents rented the movie and I was like really excited and we put it in. I'm like, what's this? This isn't a cartoon. I understand.
Egon cut his hair.
And then I saw that it was live action. My mind was completely blown. I was a little confused about where Winston was.
They made a movie about the cartoon?
But the first time I saw the Ecto-1 come out of that fire house, oh my God, I was all in. And I watched that movie about 5 million times.
Mm. I was devastated when I watched that movie once I was older and realized, oh, the Ecto-1 isn't cool at all. It's a piece of garbage.
Yeah, that's kind of the joke.
I was like, it's such a great car. It's like a hearse.
It's covered on flashing lights and like weird technology and stuff.
Yeah,
oh my God.
It's the same thing as with the Millennium Falcon. I thought that was the coolest ship and it turns out, no, it's actually a piece of crap also.
It's supposed to be like a space semi.
Yeah.
So here's the thing about the real Ghostbusters cartoon. It was created by it was run by a guy named Joe Michael Straczynski, who also ran Babylon 5, a show that I really enjoyed in the 90s. And I was aware of that because he did like lots of message board, like news group posts, and he talked at some length about running Ghostbusters the show. And the thing about that show is that he specifically aimed it both at a kids audience and an adult audience at a very early like from the start of its run. So he actually did not pull punches in terms of the horror aspect. And I remember actually being pretty freaked out by some of the stories, including one about a boogeyman that takes kids and turns them into basically itself.
The Grundle.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
the Grundle
that
episode.
The whole thing is an allegory for child molesters.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean there's an episode where the Ghostbusters go to hell. There's an episode where they get sucked into the containment unit and are put on trial for their crimes against ghosts. It was very, very dark storytelling.
They did an episode that was basically like the Poltergeist.
Yeah.
But then, of course, the executives got involved and discovered that Slimer was the most popular part of that show. And that was how we got into the Slimer and the real Ghostbusters era.
Yeah. And as for me, similar to Kat, I watched the cartoon first, was obsessed with it. My friend Philip and I, my next door neighbor, would play Ghostbusters every day. And then Ghostbusters 2 came out. I was too young for Ghostbusters 1. It was not even on my radar. I'm like, oh, there's a Ghostbusters movie now. And I loved it. Later in life, I was like, it's not great. But it's weird that I was born in 82. So I saw Back to the Future 2 and Ghostbusters 2 first. And I always had this sense until I was like a late teenager that, oh, the first movies were the boring ones. Like Ghostbusters 2 has slime and all these cool scenes. And Back to the Future 2 has all the cool future stuff. Why do I want to watch a movie about the 50s? Who cares? So
Ghostbusters 2 felt much more like it was influenced by the cartoon in a lot of ways. Yes.
It really was. I mean, I think it was just made to capitalize on the success of the cartoon, which is why everyone is phoning it in, because they're like, there's a lot of money on the table and we don't care, but we'll say these lines and rehash the first movie story.
It'll sell toys
for money.
Sure.
Yeah.
For some reason, in the late 80s, early 90s, everybody was obsessed with slime. Like, that was a thing. Like, Ghostbusters had slime, Turtles had slime, Nickelodeon had slime.
Yeah. Well,
slime.
It all started with You Can't Do That on television.
Yeah, and I do feel like gross out humor was a bigger thing in the 80s and 90s, like Ren and Stimpy, gross cartoons, and slime and being slimed and things like that. I don't know where it came from. Maybe the Clinton morals brought us all down to the slime level. Who knows? I'm being ironic, by the way. But yeah, I mean, that's. I just wanted to ask everybody how they found Ghostbusters. But talk about the games. This was really hard to research because there's two games called The Real Ghostbusters. There's two games called Ghostbusters. It's very hard to pin them down. There's also many versions of many of these different games. But one thing I'm going to do, which might get tedious, who knows, we'll find out, is I'm going to play the version of the Ghostbusters theme found in each of these games, at least a little sample of it that we can react to, because some of them are good, some of them are not good.
And
but
you won't be able to get it out of your head for the next month or so.
You really won't. I got to say, I think Ghostbusters 1 is a great movie, great performances, great story. I think the theme is instrumental in the success of the Ghostbusters. I don't know why. I can't pin this down, but I feel like having a titular theme song was a big 80s thing. But it's such a great, great, fun song that I think like it helped contribute to the success of the movie. Even if it did steal from Huey Lewis, we all know that story. You know, I Want a New Drug is basically the Ghostbusters theme in some way. Huh. There was a class act – no, not class action lawsuit, but there was a settlement involved in that. But yeah, so I guess we can move on to the first game in our series here, which is just called Ghostbusters. It came out in holiday of 1984 for the Commodore 64. There are 10 different versions of this game, many different computer platforms. But the version that I think most people played in America is the NES version, which came out in 1988, which is actually a 1986 Famicom game. But I do want to play the Commodore 64 theme and then the NES theme because they're a bit different. So here's Commodore 64.
Ghostbusters!
We get that nice little sample. So it's okay. I mean, I think
one sound
should,
channel.
Yeah, I should say that depending on which version you had, it had like a bouncing ball lyrics.
Yeah, I think the Master System version did. Well, here's the NES theme. It's much, much dinkier. This is a very bad port, by the way. Michael's totally right. This is the NES theme. I'll skip forward to the actual meat of the song. It's so bad.
Yep. Channels.
I know. It's like, dudes, you have four channels on the NES. But
and
yeah.
Then it plays through the entirety of the game.
That's all you hear in the entire game. I mean, I don't think the C64 game even had music after that intro scene. But this game was created by David Crane. Very famous developer. He made Pitfall, Grand Prix, Freeway, and Fishing Derby for the Atari 2600, amongst other games.
He made A Boy and His Blob, didn't he?
That too, yeah. And Little Computer People. So he's a very notable designer, and this game is very good and advanced for the time. It is a very, very primitive and simple game now, and it was in 88 for the NES, but this is a 1984 computer game, and it is pretty interesting in a weird like action slash simulation context. There's action scenes, but you are running a business at the same time.
Yeah, and the conceit is that you're running the Ghostbusters at the beginning of the game. You get $10,000 from the bank that you can spend on equipment, and you have to kind of trick out your car, decide what you want to take into battle, and the battle is just like position two Ghostbusters on either side of the screen.
Pretty much, yeah.
Try to get the ghosts in your streams over the trap and then trap them and you make money.
And all the ghosts are basically the same icon, which they did not change for the NES version, although they could have by that time made new sprites. It's just like this smiling ghost icon that is the only ghost in the game, yeah. basically.
And I want to say, like, I played the crap out of this on Apple II when I was a kid.
Okay.
I loved it. It was one of my favorite games. And I played the NES one for the first time yesterday. And it's like it took everything and made it quantifiably worse. Mm-hmm. Like, it looks like it's for the Intellivision. And just the way that it's structured, like in the other versions, you get $10,000 at first, and then you go through a shop screen, you buy all the equipment that you want, and you go out into the world to bus ghosts. And in this one, first thing you have to do is go all the way across town to the shop icon, buy all the equipment that you need, including proton packs, which you don't have to buy in the other versions. And then you go around and start busting ghosts. The only thing that it really has to recommend it over the other versions is that you can adjust the angle of your streams.
That's right. And there is a true final level. We'll get to that soon. But yeah, Michael is right. It is a business game where you are setting up a Ghostbusters franchise. In fact, the computer versions have you enter your name at the beginning. So it's like, I'm this guy. You're not playing as the actual Ghostbusters. And essentially, this game is – there's a world map. You are a floating Ghostbusters icon. When Ghost attack a building, you drag the icon over to that building, click on it, and then there's a driving scene where you drive mm-hmm. to the thing and you dodge ghosts. You pick up gas and money, I think.
And you have to dodge like every drunk driver in New York.
Lots of drunk drivers. Yeah. It was before Giuliani cracked down on them. But yeah, but essentially I found in playing this game, the entire game is about building up enough resources for the final battle. That is not the same in the C64 version. I'm not sure about the other computer versions, but there is no final boss in the C64 version. Once you reach the final encounter, you have to send two or three Ghostbusters into the building by running in between the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man's legs.
Yeah, he's jumping up and down.
Yeah, and what? Once you get two into the building, they run up and it's over. That's basically it.
It just has to be enough to cross the streams.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it should be noted, I'm burying the lead here, that this was a previously existing David Crane project named Car Wars. They got the license kind of late and they were like, we need this out by Christmas. We're not sure if anyone will care about Ghostbusters by then. Obviously, they didn't know it would be such a hit that people loved and would attach themselves to. But this game was really rushed development. So the C64 version has – you can definitely tell like, oh, there's no ending. A lot of things are kind of slight, but they still made the most of what they had with this design that they had for it.
I played the NES game and I mean at the time, you know, the box was just the logo and I was like, oh, that's exciting. But then, you know, you actually start playing it and it's like you have the Ghostbusters logo and it's kind of in a city or something. You know, I was not that old and I had no idea what the hell was going on.
Yeah, there's no explanation. You're just like, bam, on the world map with no like, what? I'm an icon now? What does that mean?
Yeah, and I didn't really know how to play these kinds of games, right? Like this idea of building up your resources to be able to take on Zool, et cetera. Like I was used to the straight-ahead action games like Mega Man 2 and Mario and all that stuff. This was actually kind of a common problem with licensed games of the time where it's like, what the hell's going on? What am I doing? Like, why are these mechanics so bad? I didn't really understand the concept of a bad game or why a game would be bad. I just knew it was like
– upholding the ET legacy.
Yes.
It was just like this game, like I don't understand it. Like I mean, but at least it wasn't as bad as the Back to the Future games, which freaking really did make no sense whatsoever.
They're all bad. Also, yeah, in the NES version, your car ran out of gas constantly. Like, yeah. You could manage 1.5 trips on average before it ran out of gas.
So if I'm remembering the NES version right, I did play it. I borrowed it from a friend. You have to climb a building at the end, right? It's like the prequel to the Shinra building if you take that option in Final Fantasy VII.
It's actually a sort of take on the scene in the Ghostbusters where they're running up the stairs and they're all very tired because they're middle-aged men carrying these heavy proton packs.
Which is funny when it's just like, you know, a scene in the movie of people being exhausted. But less entertaining when you actually have to do that climb yourself and it's very tedious and you just
keep
going.
And it's insanely hard.
It's a miserable level. And as I said so you're trying to earn money to buy things, upgrade your car, but really the three most expensive items or the three most vital items, one is very expensive, are items just for the final level. One is bait that will distract ghosts. One is armor that will protect you from more hits from the ghosts when you're climbing that tower. And one does something else, but they're all related to that final level. So most of the game is just like building yourself up for that final encounter. So in the NES game, perhaps in other versions, I'm not sure, but in the NES game for sure, you climb that tower. And the final encounter is with a seemingly topless Gozer localized as Gorza. And it's sort of you're dodging things from the two dogs on the side of her, like bullet hell shooter style. And you're just shooting her as you're standing side by side with two of the Ghostbusters. Who knows what happened to the third one that came up with you? I don't know if he jumped out the window or something. But that is the final boss fight. Well, it was probably Winston,
You just hit a button to alternate between the two. So if they added a third one, it might get confusing.
Yeah, that would be too much. But
it's Gorza in the Sega Master System version also, which is, I think, the best version that I've played.
So I remember – I'm glad I never asked my mom for a Master System. But in the department store Hills, the now-defunct department store, they always had a Master System on display. And it was always playing Ghostbusters. And I would just walk up to it and just have no idea what to do. But it looked so cool and I knew what the Ghostbusters were. And I think it is still the best-looking version of this game. I don't know if it has that final level in it, but the NES one definitely does.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's no likeness rights in this game. That would be a common thread throughout these games for the most part. Just three white Ghostbusters. Again, in the C64 version, you put your name in, but the NES version just drops you onto a world map. And this game is one of the more infamous and sad localizations where the ending is the most you could mess up the word congratulations. So in a previous or future episode, we mentioned how the California Raisins game gave you the text congratu-raisins. That was made by Americans. That's fine, but still angering. So the NES ending says congratulation, not congratulations. I'm forgetting what the original word is. This is so bad. Congratulations. Instead of congratulations, it's congratulation.
Singular.
Yeah, singular. You have completed a great game and proved with two O's the justice of our culture. Now go and rest, our heroes.
I love that it said you have completed a great game. Like it's self-advertising at the end of the game that you just finished.
Lies.
The localization was so bad I forgot the word congratulations. I just did it again. Congratulations. Okay, I'm going to forget that word because I keep seeing congratulation in front of my eyes.
So forgive me. Like the first time I saw the end of this game was from the Angry Video Game Nerd, and he like didn't even know how to finish – like get up the stairs because it was so bad.
Yeah,
like,
I mean
he couldn't dodge those ghosts.
I think that self-congratulatory ending was kind of a thing back then because when you beat Goonies 2, Annie the Mermaid says, hooray for Konami and the Goonies 2.
Goonies 2 was full of Konami references.
Goonies 2 was great, but yeah, very self-referential.
But yeah, in that final battle, obviously, the stairway trek, the controls are different too. You tap the A button to advance the Ghostbusters. You don't move them with the control stick.
And the ghosts come in at awkward angles.
Yeah, it's needlessly complex and just punishing. And again, the entire game in this NES version is just building yourself up for that final battle with Gorza.
Who was the
immortal Gorza?
Who was the developer?
I think Bits Laboratory or something like that. I don't know. Maybe Jeremy can tell us what else they worked on, but I don't know.
I can't remember.
They're like sub-Micronics in terms of ports,
I don't know about that.
Oh, no. Micronics is like Nintendo EAD compared to Bits Laboratory, I think. But yeah, that is Ghostbusters. Any final thoughts before we move on? I mean, it's – again, we're coming down hard on it, but the original version was great for 84. Yeah. The NES version was a bad port and too simple in 88. I think that's really the message I'm sending.
I think the non-NES versions are still pretty playable if you can get them to work. The Master System one is still fun, but yeah, the NES one, please don't judge this game by the NES one.
Yeah. This is kind of a theme with the Ghostbusters games in general. It's no matter what the quality, at least it faintly resembles the actual source material, which is actually kind of a hit and miss thing with games of that vintage. So
no, you're right, Kat. Like, this has the fundamental act of catching and trapping ghosts, which a lot of games would miss, which is a very satisfying kind of action to do. Like, you're pulling them in and then you're pulling them down into the trap.
It's like Pokemon, but without the ability to make ghosts your party members.
Exactly. And maybe like in Dragon Quest, god damn it, Ghostbusters Monsters, you could if there was an RPG. But
I also like that the non-NES versions kind of were about teaching kids to work within a budget because you could pick four different cars in the other versions, and like they each had like The cheaper ones were slower and had fewer storage slots, but they let you spend more money on equipment.
It kind of sounds like Oregon Trail. Like which character do you want to start as?
There's definitely some similarities.
Yeah, I think I got to track down.
Of dysentery.
I have to track down the C64 version because I'm clearly missing something. But yeah. We should move on to the next game, The Real Ghostbusters. So The Real Ghostbusters is a 1987 arcade game that came to various computer platforms. This was in my local arcade. I don't know about you guys, but this is a Data East game that is based on another game that's called Make You Hunter G, which is Labyrinth Hunter G. That game is much more complex. We can talk about what this game is. This game reminds me a lot of the Moonwalker arcade game in that it is a isometric-ish shooter with three characters who are all identical. And instead of playing three Michael Jacksons, you play as three white Ghostbusters, not named. I mean, like, they had the license for The Real Ghostbusters. They could have used those character designs, but I think it was too much work to add all of those individual sprites to this kind of kind of like ROM hack of a previous game. I don't know.
Are they ambiguous enough that you can pretend one is Kate McKinnon, one is
they're all white men.
They're all white dudes with, I think, dark hair.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I mean, I play this in the arcade just because I love the cartoon. Did anyone but me play this game?
I played the crap out of this.
You did? Okay.
I always wish that there would be an NES port. There never was. But yeah, I thought it was a lot of fun. I played every chance I got when I was a kid. And one thing I like, I think that's different from the original Make You Hunter G. Like, you have two types of weapons. You have the shots and the capture beam.
Yeah.
And the idea is that, like, you're facing all these physical monsters. You wear them down with the shots, and then you reel in the ghost with the capture beam. And I think you have, like, a limited amount of energy there.
You do, yeah, for your capture beam. And Slimer is in this game and not in Labyrinth Hunter G, obviously. He is, like, a sort of a shield or something. You pick up Slimer as a power-up.
Yes.
That is the one real tie to the cartoon. Also, I feel the enemies are kind of directly tied to the cartoon. They have that kind of grotesque garbage pail kid, overly complex and gross ways designed to them.
Lots of weird bulbous shapes.
Yeah, lots of like big lips and tongues hanging out and things like that. Unfortunately, in doing research, I learned Make You Hunter G is a much more complex game, and that there are six kinds of guns in that game instead of just having the two variants of your shooter in Ghostbusters arcade game. And it looks a hell of a lot like a Ghostbusters game, Make You Hunter G, right down to certain enemies, like layouts. Like, they didn't work very hard to convert this to Ghostbusters. I feel like they got the license. It was just a quick fix, maybe a few weeks of altering sprites and altering level layouts. But it really is like a maze-style game, Real Ghostbusters for the arcade, which ties into the Labyrinth Hunter arcade game. And I did play a lot of this, but
is it kind of like an Alien Syndrome-ish experience?
A bit. I don't think there's any backtracking like there is in Alien Syndrome.
It's sort of like something like Ikari Warriors, where it's like the screen is constantly scrolling upward. And
Yeah, you're always moving in one direction, but you're picking up keys to open doors, and it's all very very of that kind of game. It's not that great. It's not terrible. Let's hear the theme and see how they pulled it off. I think it's not that great. It's kind of all over the place.
They're really trying to add a lot, like so much. It doesn't really work. It's really messy.
Danceable. Yeah, it's not recognizable.
It feels like...
How do you mess up an FM synthesis version of the Ghostbusters theme?
I don't know. They didn't get the sheet music from Ray Parker, I guess.
It's very, very upbeat, though.
And it really is.
I think one of the things that makes this game kind of hard to play now if you're like trying to emulate it is that the arcade had those clicky sticks that you could turn, like Ikari Warriors had. Yeah.
Oh, I forgot about that, and I played so much of this. You're right, Michael.
So, like, if you're playing it on MAME, you have to, like, hit two shoulder buttons basically to rotate your character. It's a little awkward.
Yeah, yeah. I forgot about the clicky buttons. But if you can find it, play it for, I don't know, a dollar's worth of your money. It's just a weird element of Ghostbusters that is not an original Ghostbusters game, but it's still okay. It's not great, but if I experienced it at least once. It's the same with Moonwalker. Moonwalker is not great either, but it's just a fun oddity to play, I think. So we're moving on to why Kat Bailey is here, because she is known for this game, I think, the most.
Am I?
More than your love of RPGs and Madden, you are known as someone
Ghostbusters
who
Gundam?
Ghostbusters Gundam. Ghostbusters Musou. Ghostbusters 2 for the NES, released in April of 1990. Before we move on, let's hear the theme. This is much better than the NES theme by far. Pretty creepy. See, they're using the sound channel. This is pretty good. We're getting there.
It's all coming back now.
The nightmares are coming back.
This one sounds more like A Boy and His Blob than the original by David Crane.
It really does. But Kat, I find this game to be an indefensible piece of shit.
I agree, Bob.
It is. It would be tried at Nuremberg if I had my way. But wow. It's a war crime of a game.
There's way worse games on the NES. I'm sorry.
Not many of them try to kill you immediately for walking right.
First of all, that spider, like, it doesn't really matter, because you run forward pretty fast and it, like, gets off the screen immediately and whatever. Mm-hmm. So I guess I should go over my history with the game really quickly. It was the first game I bought on the NES. I was in a store. I saw the box. It was Ghostbusters 2, and I'm like,
the real, actual live action actors on the box, right?
Yes, it does.
They're all pointing their proton beams at you.
Yeah, with the over the logo with the 2, and also I got Afterburner from Tengen, which was a whole different story. But I took it home and I started playing it, and of course it was insanely hard because there's so much garbage on that screen at all times. There's stuff like, there are these like guillotine things that are coming down really fast, and there are like these monsters that are kind of bouncing really awkwardly. And bouncing heads that you have to let them jump kind of over you.
Yeah.
Slimer, but he's kind of pooping slime. But it doesn't hurt you. It just slows you down. But that's really annoying.
This is what I call the Bart versus the Space Mutant school of level design, where it's just like no rhyme or reason, just crazy crap swirling around the screen. You might get hit. You might not. Your hitbox is awful. Who cares? Like,
exactly.
Every level, there's no design to it. Just like a gauntlet of hell.
It's just like, yeah, a bunch of random crap showing up.
And you're shooting. And everything is reversed. So you're going left. This is a thing that everybody's always talking about. And you're pressing A to shoot instead of B to shoot.
Immediately, it breaks every rule. You're running the wrong direction and hitting the wrong buttons. They messed up big time.
And you're using a slime cannon instead of a proton.
Yeah, it's a shooter.
But it was
it's
Ghostbusters 2, right? So I don't know. But I mean, it was very faithful to the source material. For an NES game, it looked good. It had a variety of gameplay modes that were fairly competently executed. Okay, like the driving stuff. The driving stuff, I will go on
the
a limb and say
driving is the best part of the game, but
it's
not
better than
great.
Like the speeder bike stuff. It was actually pretty enjoyable. I think the worst level in that game is actually the courthouse, because that game took forever to finally beat. It was ridiculously hard. There's so much crap on the screen. It took me literally years to get to the Statue of Liberty level, which actually has the higher and higher. Like, it was actually licensed, apparently.
It was. I was looking at the credits. So Chris, I talked about this with Chris Antista, and I guess he thought they kind of stole it because, you know, you can get away with that at the time. But in the credits, I was surprised to see them name check the writer, like use with permission, whatever. They paid to use Higher and Higher from that famous scene from the movie.
Yes, they did.
Yeah.
Is that the Bobby Brown song? Too
no.
hot to handle, too cold to hold. They're called the Ghostbusters and they're in control. Have them throw a party for a bunch of children because all the wild slime is under the building.
The best part of that song is it tells you the entire plot of the movie beat by beat, so you don't have to watch it.
Yep. I found the driving sequences really disturbing, because when you get hit, like, your
car melts.
It's covered in slime and, like, it gets wrecked. But the slime, I think especially, like, in the opening demo mode more than in the actual game, is bright red. So it looks like the car is covered
bleeding
in the Ghostbusters' blood.
It's funny you mention that, because the attract screen demo is someone really screwing up in one of those driving levels. Just someone just
running
eating
into,
shit constantly.
Yes,
yeah.
Running into barricades and stuff. You run into a barricade. Unlike Battletoads, you do not die immediately. You just take damage. And actually, it looks pretty good. Like, when the Ecto-1 hits the barricade, like, it actually kind of goes – and then the hood kind of crumples a little bit and it flashes and then you keep going.
Yeah.
So.
And to talk about who designed this, it's designed by Dan Kitchen, brother of Gary Kitchen, game developer. He developed Crackpots for Atari 2600, one of my favorite games. But mostly he's known for founding Absolute Entertainment with his brother and making a lot of really bad games, like a lot of the Ren and Stimpy and Simpsons games that are just god-awful. I'm sorry, dude, but they're bad.
It all makes sense now.
Yeah, just like you can see the bad Simpsons games in Ghostbusters 2 for sure, I think.
Absolutely.
I think so. Look, I'm never going to say that this is the best game on the NES. Not by a long
shot. You're here to so I can attack you about this game.
I would never even say that it's a good game. But I think people get too hung up on the left to right thing, and also or the right to left thing, whatever. And also the reversal, just because. I mean, yeah, it's different from everything else, but you get used to it pretty quickly. And to be honest, I replayed this game at GamePro in 2011. And I was actually shocked and legitimately terrified by how the muscle memory completely came back.
Wow.
I got all the way to the final level, which is the art museum, where you have to run all four Ghostbusters through the giant gauntlet so they can get to Vigo. And then there is actually no final boss.
Yeah, you get to the painting and it's just like, yay, congratulations.
You just get a variation on the cutscene it forces you to sit through every time you die.
Yeah, which is actually Vigo looks like Vigo.
Yep.
I was always a little confused because it would say you have to beat this game before a certain time. And I'm like, what? So I have a time limit?
There is a little clock in the UI.
Yeah, exactly.
But it doesn't pass in real time. It just is like every level is a new hour maybe. I don't know.
I guess.
You have to beat it before midnight because Vigo will resurrect at midnight.
It confused me. But I got a lot of enjoyment out of this game. It also frustrated the hell out of me, but whatever. Like, there are such worse licensed games on the NES. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, but it's still – I mean, so most of the game is this bad shooter slash platformer and some of it's driving. And looking at – I watched a long play of this, which is not very long, by the way.
No,
but
it's very short.
40% of this game, I would say, is that Statue of Liberty sequence. It is like the brunt of the game. It takes up the entire middle.
It's also the worst level too.
It is really bad.
But it's basically like – it's more or less the same as the shooting bits, the running and shooting bits, except that you're just piloting a Statue of Liberty that's only ever seen from the waist up.
Yeah, it's more like a Space Invaders-y kind of shooter, I think.
Galaga. This game does not answer the question of whether or not she wears underwear.
Nope.
You can aim the arm and you're shooting flames, I guess, at the ghosts that are coming at you. And they're coming at you very fast. And if they hit you, like at a certain point, the statue will just go and sink into the waves. But there's actually like a cutscene. I think you see the foot stepping up to the art museum.
You do just the foot. Like we can't animate anymore, but here's a foot coming down. Yes, it's very Monty Python, but much smaller. So what I couldn't get to in that previous episode from 8 years ago is that there are computer versions that are much different. So. Most of them have a whopping three levels, which was kind of standard for some kinds of games on the computers at that time. On the computers, I sound like Hank Hill or something, but I'm sorry. So one level is Ray being lowered through the sewers. You're dodging things. You're shooting things. It's a very big, beautiful sprite, especially on the Amiga version. Another level, the middle level, is that Statue of Liberty section with the kind of shoot 'em up. And the final one is an isometric battle against Vigo where you're kind of like – real-time Final Fantasy tacticsing, like moving around Vigo to shoot him with all your proton beams at once. It's very strange. If you watch videos of this, I'm like, this does not look fun or intuitive at all, and this is way too ambitious to actually – for me to want to play it.
The weird thing about the PC version though is that you're controlling the Statue of Liberty from that first-person perspective.
Yes.
Looking at her feet, holding an NES controller.
That's actually the DOS version, Michael, which is unique to all the computer versions. And that is a unique level where you are – it's a first-person one. You're holding an NES regular controller, not the advantage they use in the movie.
Yeah, not the dog bone.
So it's doubly weird.
Yeah. Actually it's – which one is the big giant arcade stick kind of
thing?
That's
the
NES advantage.
That's advantage. What's the dog bone?
The dog bone is the one that came out with the remodeled second version of the arcade.
But yeah, they were using the advantage in the movie.
I was so excited to see that NES advantage. Oh my God. any reference to Nintendo?
The Ghostbusters like NES, so do I.
There's that same impulse that made us go and watch The Wizard.
And Louis Tully like making reference to Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Instead of wanting to make out with Janine, which there's no argument there for me. But oh God, I'm disgusting. But let's move on. So the DOS version is very much like kind of like a cabal kind of shooter where you're seeing the backs of the Ghostbusters and you're aiming a cursor and they're shooting everything. It's more of a shooter game of that era.
But then it also does the different level design thing where like you have to go and scoop slime from the sewers.
Yeah, you're also building up resources to do things with said resources. I was just watching a video that was not narrated. I wasn't sure what the sort of interstitial slime collecting levels we're doing, but you're like gathering slime, testing it, maybe buying things with the product of that. I don't know, but
you can play this one on Internet Archive. It's very difficult to control because it's like mouse only.
This game sounds very, very heavily influenced by CinemaWare.
No, you're totally right. I can really see that.
This, you know, kind of in the days before 3D graphics and polygons sort of unified everything where you can have multiple views seamlessly and switch back and forth.
Like different game modes.
They create all these different modes, and the idea is just like we've got to recreate the movie experience, and you know, no one view properly gets the experience across. So let's just do everything, and you get these really, really sort of multiple split personality games.
Yeah, like Defender of the Crown.
Really,
they're
mini
game collections,
absolutely.
Basically.
Yeah. Yeah, it's Three Stooges.
And I like that the DOS version like added a thing where like if all the Ghostbusters were incapacitated, like you had to break them out of the asylum, and they had to like rappel down the side of this hospital.
Oh, I didn't see this part. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Hmm.
That's a nice touch. But I mean, overall, the biggest flaw of every version of the Ghostbusters 2 game is that there's no trapping of ghosts, which again, I feel like
– Oh, no. That's not true. You can shoot out a trap in Ghostbusters 2.
You can?
That's actually one of the key strategies is – there's a giant like Slimer thing in the courthouse. You can like actually shoot out a trap.
Weird. In the long play I watched, there was no trapping. So I guess I'm wrong. But I guess it's not as essential then. It's more of a shooter. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's definitely much more of a shooter.
Yeah.
And if anything, one of the themes that I'm kind of getting from this is that developers really didn't know how to translate Ghostbusters into a video game. Because at that time, like so much stuff was platforming or shooting or whatever. So they're like, oh, let's turn the slime cannon into kind of a shooter, like an actual projectile thing. Like they didn't know how to kind of render this one giant beam that would like grab onto the ghost rather than just blowing them up.
I'm sure that was a physics nightmare.
Yeah, a bit too complex for the NES or older computers to handle. But we're going to take a brief break. We'll come back with Ghostbusters for the Genesis. We'll see you then.
This week's Retronauts is sponsored by BarkBox. I know what you're thinking. Jeremy, why would I need a box of memorabilia of failed Supreme Court nominee Robert Bork? But no, you've misheard me. It's BarkBox, not BorkBox. BarkBox is about dogs and happiness, not justice. It's a monthly service that ships a box of all-natural, edible treats and interesting toys to your four-legged pal. And you can sign up at getbarkbox.com/game, where you can customize your plan to your dog's needs. Whether they're a little dog, a medium-sized dog, or a big one, you can also designate if your dog has specific allergies or other health issues. BarkBox will send you a different themed box of puppy goods on the 15th of every month, with free shipping in the continental U.S. BarkBox only ships edibles made in the U.S. and Canada, and they source many of their goods from small businesses that don't otherwise have a means of national distribution. So every month, your canine pal gets a unique box. And if your pooch isn't happy with the contents of their latest BarkBox, you can even get a substitute item in return. Right now, Retronauts listeners can get a free bonus month of service for signing up for a 6- or 12-month plan by going to getbarkbox.com/game. Because you may not care about failed Supreme Court nominees, but you love your dog.
My name is Raven, professional wrestling superstar, world-class idiot, and raconteur extraordinaire. Join me for my new podcast, The Raven Effect. Every Monday here on the Jericho Network on Podcast One, we'll be covering current events and any and all topics that can be properly bantered. Download and listen to the show on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, or subscribe on iTunes. Quote the Raven, nevermore.
You know, when you're a kid, there are a lot of things that you think exist. Unicorns, dragons, mermaids, you name it. When you're a kid, it's real. But when you find out later that they don't, well, it's kind of disappointing. Of course, as you get older, you get over the disappointment. But when you're looking to buy a car, there's nothing worse than finding the one of your dreams online, and then you find out later it doesn't really exist. It's not true. That's why at TrueCar, they show you real pricing on actual inventory. This isn't pricing offered to you by TrueCar. It's an actual VIN-based price from a TrueCar certified dealer in your area. Real prices. And these aren't just any dealers either. TrueCar certified dealers are a carefully curated network of dealers committed to transparency. They offer competitive prices and a faster, easier buying experience for you. It's a fact. TrueCar customers are more likely to enjoy a faster buying process when they connect with the TrueCar certified dealers. And, on average, they save over $3,000 off the MSRP. So when you're ready to buy that dream car, visit TrueCar and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states.
If you're like me, you love to read, but you don't want to have your eyes constantly glued to something in front of your face. I mean, honestly, constantly reading a book, that's no better than one of those darned whippersnappers with their iPhones. It seems like a real catch-22, but fortunately, there is another way to catch up on Catch-22 by Joseph Heller, and that's through Audible.com. Audible offers over 180,000 different books and titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or other MP3 player, all in audiobook format, so you can still make eye contact with others while still enjoying classic literature or modern literature. And right now, you can get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/game. So download a book like Catch-22 today at audibletrial.com/game and fill your mind with smart words without abandoning social niceties.
Are you troubled by strange noises in the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread in your basement or attic?
Have you or any of your family ever seen a spook, specter, or ghost?
If the answer is yes, then don't wait another minute. Pick up the phone and call the professionals.
Ghostbusters!
Our courteous and efficient staff is on call 24 hours a day to serve all your supernatural elimination needs.
We're ready to believe you!
So we're back from our break, and we're here to talk about the next game on our list in chronological order, which is the Ghostbusters Genesis game, just titled Ghostbusters. So it's the second game that is just titled Ghostbusters. So this was developed by Sega and Compile. I'm not sure how much Sega had to do with this. This could be just Compile, but it's unclear, as most games are from this era, because lots of credits are pseudonyms, lots of credits are unspoken. But for some reason, this game gives credit to Activision in the opening titles, like because maybe they bought the license from Activision or they needed permission. I don't know how this worked, but it's really weird timing because this game is almost exactly a year after Ghostbusters 2, several years after the cartoon, but it's based on neither one of those. Instead, it's an interquel just called Ghostbusters that is being released as the Ghostbusters brand is sort of dying on the vine. Like, as we talked about before, executives were brought into the cartoon and they sort of ruined it. There were no more movies announced or no more plans for movies. I think no one wanted to do another movie. And it was an odd time for an original Ghostbusters game based on that first movie. Did anyone play this Genesis game when it was contemporary?
Not at the time. I remember seeing it in EGM.
But. Yeah. I mean, I think this is the first playable in modern day Ghostbusters game we're talking about, like something that's fun to play now. It's like it resembles an actual video game that you can enjoy in some
Excuse
way.
Excuse me, Ghostbusters 2 on the NES is fun to play now.
No, it's not, Ken.
So my
that's
Ghostbusters
your Stockholm Syndrome talk.
My Ghostbusters story is that I borrowed the NES Ghostbusters from a friend and decided never to play another Ghostbusters game again.
Jesus,
in my life.
Jeremy. You missed
it was
out.
So bad.
You missed out, Jeremy, because everybody knows I'm a huge weeb. This is the anime Ghostbusters game because it's basically SD Ghostbusters.
Oh, yeah.
Because all of the characters – and I feel like this was an intentional choice to show off like the 16-bit power of the Genesis where – all the characters had huge heads that looked exactly like the actors in very unflattering ways in the case of Bill Murray. But
so it's kind of a Kato and Ken sort of thing?
Yes, exactly. In fact, I wrote that down. These sprites remind me so much of JJ and Jeff or Kato and Ken, that TG-16 game where they're really capturing the look of real people. Not so much JJ and Jeff, but with Kato and Ken. Those were Japanese comedians. But that gives it a very distinctive look, and the enemies are very creative. I feel like this game really is the most fun and evocative of that sort of real Ghostbusters spirit, with crazy ghost designs and, you know, big-headed sprites, just a really fun kind of romp. I don't know. How do you guys feel about this game?
It's a look that I really associate with that era and 16-bit game design. A lot of them were based on arcades of that era, and for some reason, big-headed sprites were a thing back then. So
it has a really arcadey feel, though. I mean, just in like the terms of the gameplay and the visual effects and sounds, like it reminded me a lot of like the Willow arcade game. If you ever played,
Heads on that one too.
It had sort of a similar feel.
Big detailed sprites were a thing because it's like, oh, look at all the detail on these like sprites. This is amazing. Everything's gigantic.
Mm-hmm. And I feel more than 8x8 sprites on a line.
And this era of Sega was very much about, we're going to give you arcade style experiences, like short games that are very hard but somewhat complex. And this is definitely one of those. And there's a bit of a story, a bit of a poorly localized story in that so destroying Gozer puts the Ghostbusters out of business, and then mysterious earthquakes and ghost phenomenon starts happening in NYC. And the Ghostbusters have to find puzzle pieces to put together to find out who is behind all of this.
Oh,
so,
boy.
Yeah, I believe there are maybe 5 or 6 levels. But the downside of this game is that the backgrounds are very repetitive. The levels are very maze-like. There's not a lot of – I mean, like – and again, it's a very Japanese-style game. I mean, you have very goofy-looking Ghostbuster faces even though they're based on the actors. You have very anime-style sprites. And also you have like, here's the Ghostbusters fire level. Here's the Ghostbusters ice level. Here's the Ghostbusters sewer level. Like every type of Japanese game level is represented in Ghostbusters for the Genesis. It's funny in that way. But – there is no Winston, which is an important thing to point out. An auto mission. I don't know. How do you guys feel about this? No Winston playable. You choose between one of three Ghostbusters, and Bill Murray is the most average of all the Ghostbusters.
He's the Mario.
Yeah, I feel like the Winston omission happens to kind of a disturbing degree.
Yes, to the point where it's like he's not even on some versions of the first poster. It's just like, was this just casual racism, or did you not care about Winston?
He was a really minor character in the original movie. He barely does. He has no point in the original movie. He didn't have to be in it.
Originally written much more elaborately?
Yes, it was written for Eddie Murphy.
That's why he signed on. And then they're like, oh, no, you're only going to show up in like the second half, because he thought he was going to be a star from it. And that was not what happened.
I feel like Winston got screwed.
Oh, totally.
He gets a much better treatment in the 2009 Ghostbusters game, but he is sort of overlooked for the most part in every game. And even in the cartoon, he's not given much to do.
So one thing that the reboot actually does fairly well is that they give Leslie Jones a really strong part in the movie. Like, she actually matters. She gets them the car. She gets them the coveralls and all that stuff. She's a key member of the team who's there – like she's not there from the start, but she comes in much earlier in the film. She's an integral part.
Yeah. So. And Winston, I think, in the original movie, even though he comes in late and is sort of an afterthought, I feel like he is an important voice, and that he is the working class guy, just sort of the straight man to all this crazy shit happening, especially in the second movie. I feel like he's given a lot more to do, a lot more like comedic things to do instead of just, you know, being the straight man a lot of the time.
Yeah. I felt like in the cartoon he fell into the same role that a lot of African-American characters in 80s cartoons did, which is he says ooh-wee a lot.
Yeah. He did say ooh-wee a lot in that cartoon. You're right. And it's funny because I was watching a lot of videos about the real Ghostbusters cartoon, which I loved and is still worth revisiting in some cases. Some episodes aren't so great. But so what happened was they brought in this the network brought in these consultants. They all had PhDs in education. They were like, we need to make this show better for children. And the creator was like, this is the number one show on the network. We are already good. Go away. And then he left the show because their influence creeped into creative decisions. But they said essentially, we need to give each Ghostbusters a role in the show, more of a role, like more of a defined role. So it was said, okay, Egon is the brain. That mm-hmm. makes sense. Ray is going to be the hands because he's more of the, you know, mechanic type. He's more a hands-on guy. Of course, Bill Murray's character, Peter Venkman, is the mouth. And they're like, and Winston's the driver, you know, that part of your body. So there's a lot of casual racism creeping into Ghostbusters decisions. And that's why Straczynski left the series because he was like, don't touch my show. Like, we made these decisions for a reason. And they were like, no, we're going to make the show better. But they really just led to the cancellation of the real Ghostbusters, which would be named to Slimer in the real Ghostbusters. And half of the show would be a Slimer cartoon where a mad scientist is trying to capture him, and it's all done in a much more cartoony style because they're like, the Ghostbusters are too scary for kids, but that's why I like that cartoon. There were some stakes to it.
That's what was interesting about it. And like, yeah, the Slimer cartoon felt oddly like a sanitized Heathcliff.
A bit, yeah.
Ooh, that's bad.
And it is very ugly. It is not the secretly anime real Ghostbusters that I love.
What was the ghost version of the garbage ape?
Oh God! The garbage ape is an anomaly. We cannot talk about that on this podcast.
Nope.
But yes, so back to the Ghostbusters Genesis game. It's a pretty basic platformer / shooter. You earn money through every level has a mid boss, and if you wear it down enough, you can potentially trap it. It can't escape. That is the one ghost you can trap per level. You get a bonus if you trap that ghost. And between levels, you buy upgrades from a Doc Brown with a mustache, basically. That is who you buy upgrades from. It's a very nice Back to the Future homage.
Isn't Doc Brown with a mustache just Dr. Wily?
Kind of, yeah, actually. Less of a big chin to him, though. Yeah, but this is definitely Doc Brown.
I like the gravitas of the opening in the Genesis version, too, where he's like, there are ghosts appearing here and there.
Yes, here and there. Oh, no. And no matter which Ghostbuster you choose, the dialogue is the same. So you get some incongruous dialogue like Egon saying, who cares, let's party, things like that. So this game is lots of fun. It's not the best, most solid platformer / shooter, but there are fun boss fights. The ghost designs are really cool. There's like a snowman where the top ball of the snowman is the head, obviously, but the bottom snowman is another head, and they're barfing out smaller snowmen. Like, lots of fun designs like that I like to watch. But I feel like this game does hold up. I'm sure there's no way it could ever be re-released again in any format outside of 1990 on the Genesis, but it's worth downloading as a ROM just to check out. I mean, I love the sprites in this game, and I love just the crazy ghost designs. And it does fall into a very rote platformer theme level style of game, but just that Ghostbusters hook to it really makes it worth it for me. I don't know about you guys.
I feel like it kind of got lost to history because, I mean, at least in my case, I wasn't really – I mean, I was sort of aware of the Genesis pre-Super Nintendo, but, you know, that was really like the hardcore early adopter. Like, I want the top level graphics that I can possibly get.
And I'm sure it was on the box and in the commercials. Like, whenever the Ghostbusters get hit, they get these like weird goofy faces, and I'm sure was like in magazines being advertised, like, these expressive characters. Mario doesn't, like, look at you when he gets hit. You know?
I looked at that stuff in a magazine in 1990, it would have been like, must own right now. My God, this looks amazing.
I had serious urges to get a Genesis when I saw these screenshots, but just like, I don't want to ask for another console.
I also love that in addition to those freaky faces, which kind of, when I saw them yesterday, they kind of reminded me of, like, remember the second wave of Ghostbusters toys where, like, you'd squeeze their arms,
they'd
make faces?
Yeah.
Like, when you die in that game, you fall over wrapped in bandages.
Like a mummy,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, you look
right.
like a mummy. I think it's supposed to be like, you're in the hospital now, but you're just like, the ghost turned me into a mummy would have been my reaction as a kid.
Yeah, absolutely.
Reminds you of like in Cowboy Bebop and like Lupin the Third, when he gets injured, he's just like wrapped up like a mummy and that will cure him in some way.
Yep.
I don't know how. But let's hear the Genesis theme of the Ghostbusters. I don't think this is very good. I forget, but it's interesting at least.
Dark.
It's getting there. Wait, I want to hear the saxophone.
Nope.
It's a bit off. It's a bit off.
Yeah,
bit
just off. A little bit.
Let's call that an adaptation, not a...
an interpretation.
An arrangement. Yes, exactly. So let's move on to our next game, New Ghostbusters 2. This game is developed by HAL, a reliable developer, but this is a fairly simple game for them. Only released in Japan and Europe, and Activision released the Game Boy version in the U.S., which is slightly different. We'll get into that first. So, Michael, you were saying you just found out about this game?
I did, yeah. And after playing the original NES version and all these other kind of crappy Ghostbusters games that – this was a really pleasant surprise.
It's pretty interesting. It is they very rarely institute trapping into Ghostbusters games, but this is all based around shooting and trapping. And you basically select between five Ghostbusters. Lewis is one of them. Winston is here, but because you're on the NES with a limited color palette, his skin is green, unfortunately.
I think it was blue when I played.
It's sort of like a bluish green.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it's between the two. But yeah, they look like the 8-bit JRPG sprite versions of the Ghostbusters. And like Bill Murray's receding hairline is just like the iconic look in some of these games. Just like the way they give him that like kind of horseshoe baldness pattern is pretty interesting. But yeah, the gameplay is based around trapping. One Ghostbuster follows, one traps. A is your proton beam, B is your trap. And it feels really satisfying, but there's nothing more to this game than that. There are no extra weapons. There are no other kinds of gameplay. It's basically just that through these Link to the Past, Legend of Zelda style dungeon.
Well, yeah,
kind of things.
I mean, it's all top down with a maze. Like you go into a room, ghosts attack, you trap the ghost, and a little arrow appears telling you which direction to go in next.
Yeah, and it does feel a little undercooked for when this game came out. So keeping in mind this is December 1990, this was 18 months after the movie released, which was not crazy for a licensed game. Like thinking of something like GoldenEye 64 was almost 2 years after the movie. This was a similar case. But I feel like with that much time and with a developer like HAL, I would expect more. And the director is actually a pretty notable HAL director. His name is Hiroaki Suga. And he directed the first Lolo game and was the main programmer on Kirby's Adventure and is basically the main producer on the Kirby series. So like top-level talent who would go on to basically prove themselves later in life would work on this game.
I think you mean prove themselves
later. Yeah, prove with two O's. It's a more important version of that word.
Yeah, exactly.
So you played through this?
I'm excited that this is a Game Boy game also.
Yes, yes.
That comes out – it came out in 1990, which means
we'll
get to it at
up
some
to that
point.
Soon? Oh, cool.
Not soon, but within a reasonable amount of time.
I think the Game Boy version I read has remixed levels and only like 5 instead of 6 levels.
That's true, but you do get various power-ups where the NES version there is like no power-ups, nothing to pick up, just ghost trapping and shooting action. The Game Boy version would be a little different and a little more truncated, but you do get those extra power-ups. And I think it did come out a bit later, maybe 91. But that was released in America by Activision. Kat, have you played any of these games?
Hell no.
Do you have any interest in them?
I do, actually. It's amazing to me that all these games existed because I certainly was not aware of them. I thought there was an Extreme Ghostbusters game, but I could be wrong.
There is,
but we won't talk about it.
Oh, is it that bad?
I refuse.
It was for the GBA, right?
Well, Game Boy Color.
I'm talking – I really wanted to cover things that are based on the Ghostbusters,
no, that's
not
fair
just
enough.
The Extreme Ghostbusters. I'm not a true millennial. I didn't grow up with it. So,
I mean, it is funny to me that this game was apparently developed exclusively in Japan and never came out in the U.S. So.
Yeah, that's because Activision released their version of Ghostbusters 2.
Like, no, this needs to be the definitive
version. But it's funny because I wouldn't have realized that the Ghostbusters were actually that popular in Japan. So
I have to wonder, do you think that's true or did they just have an opportunity to get the license? I don't know what the Ghostbusters did in Japan.
Hollywood movies were coming out over there.
Yeah.
I'm sure it did reasonably well over there. This kind of happened with, you know, licensing issues across territories. If you look at Kimco's Bugs Bunny Crazy Castle series, that was all over the place in terms of licenses. It originally came out in Japan as a Famicom Disk System game called Roger Rabbit, then was released as a Famicom game or a Game Boy game called Mickey Mouse, and then as an NES game called Bugs Bunny Crazy Castle. So it's like three licenses on one game.
You're really getting ahead of us. That's actually the next game on our list.
That up.
Yeah. Yeah.
But before we move on, I do want to play again. We're going to play the Ghostbusters theme in all of these games. Here's the new Ghostbusters 2 NES theme. I think it's fairly accurate. Again, you got to use that noise channel, guys. If you're not using the noise channel, go home. I like it.
Yeah.
This is very late NES sounding. They're using the all of the channels.
Yeah, the noise channel is nice, deep, heady percussion.
Yes.
Yeah. Very good, Hal. Maybe the Kirby music guy did that too. Who knows?
But yeah. It looks like even though this didn't come out in the U.S. on NES, this is the game that was converted to Game Boy and released in the U.S. by Activision.
Right.
So
it's slightly
once again,
different.
Game Boy wins.
Yes, and kind of better in some ways, and what with one less level, but still I'm looking forward to your Game Boy World version of that, Game Boy World take on that.
Marking the dying gasp of Ghostbusters. As you already said, this is kind of the dying gasp of Ghostbusters. At least in the U.S. and in Japan. And I think that Ghostbusters 2 kind of
killed
like
the Ghostbusters.
It kind of hinted at it when the Ghostbusters are there and all the kids only care about He-Man.
Yeah.
Because Ghostbusters are already lame.
That seemed lame because sorry to use the same word, but in 1989, I don't think anyone cared about He-Man either.
No, He-Man was also lame by that.
Yeah. I feel like that was written when He-Man was a big deal and everyone had moved on. Maybe it was – they would have – if that was accurate, Max Landis in that scene would have been asking for Ninja Turtles or something.
Yeah, exactly.
I think so.
Wow.
So we're going to move on to the next game. Again, another game that is also the name of another game on our list, The Real Ghostbusters for Game Boy. It should be said, this game came out in October of 1993. The Ghostbusters cartoon ended in 1991. It ended in our hearts before then,
A little late to the party, must be said.
It feels like one of those, this license is cheap. Remember when there were like Gremlins and E.T. games on Game Boy Advance? That's what this feels like, really. And Jeremy,
say, this game is by Kemco. What does that mean?
It means it's secretly a part of the Crazy Castle series in a way. It feels more like a Lode Runner though. Yeah. So in Japan, this is a Mickey Mouse game. And in Europe, it's a Garfield game with my favorite name of all time. It's called Garfield Labyrinth. Because when I think of Garfield, I think of him
David Bowie.
Yes, exactly.
I think this might have also been re-released in Germany with like that Hugo character, that troll.
Oh, I didn't see that. But so the funny connection I have that Jeremy brought up earlier is that this is a Peter Venkman game in America and a Garfield game in Europe. And Lorenzo Music with one of the best voices of all time. I swear I miss that man in his voice. But he voiced both Peter Venkman and Garfield. And the story behind that is
–
not in the games, no. But
sadly.
The reason Full House's Dave Coulier replaced him is that Bill Murray saw the cartoon one day and he was like, why do I sound like Garfield? So they basically got a guy to do a Bill Murray impression to replace him, which was a real shame. But before we move on, let's hear the real Ghostbusters theme. This will be the last theme that we play because the next game will actually just use the Ray Parker song because it'll happen like 16 years later. So here's the Game Boy Real Ghostbusters. It's kind of like the NES version, I think. Not very good of the first game. So, yeah, this is basically a puzzle platformer where you play as Peter Venkman. It feels a bit like Lode Runner in that your ability is to destroy a block of the ground in front of you or behind you and to trap enemies. And there's really no ghost busting. In fact, I was looking at different versions of this game. And they're not that different. In fact, the enemies are the same. The things you're collecting are the same. It's just like a very low effort kind of character swap.
Yeah, they really just put a Peter Venkman sprite in there and said like, yeah, his power pack or proton pack is only good for digging straight down in front of him.
And it's not a very good Peter Venkman sprite either. It's,
no.
It's actually kind of bad and
it's,
not
– it's really just a dude.
Yeah, and doesn't look like him at all. I mean Peter was my favorite character. I loved every sarcastic character, which probably explains who I am today. But him and Raphael – like defined my cartoon character heroes, I think, as a kid. But yeah, I mean, there's not a lot to say. I don't think anyone played this game. I'd be surprised if it sold at all because the real Ghostbusters were nothing. There was like 93 October. It was all about Power Rangers. No kid cared about Ghostbusters by then.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, totally. I mean, but yeah, no one cares about this game. It's a very late Game Boy release, at least before the, you know, I guess Link's Awakening would come out in a few months, but that was considered kind of the end of the lifespan of that system until Pokemon, I think. So, Jeremy, are you going to argue against this or do you agree?
Just made a face.
Do you think
I just sneezed.
Okay. That was his body making a face. Do you agree with that, Jeremy? Like, 93 might have been like, oh, the Game Boy's over. People thought maybe.
I don't think I really felt like Game Boy was over until 1994, 95. So
yeah, I guess Donkey Kong 94, Donkey Kong Land.
93 was the year of the Super Game Boy. I mean,
yeah. I kind of gave it a shot in the arm, actually.
It still felt pretty relevant to me.
Yeah.
Well, this game made it seem like the Game Boy was dying anyways.
Ouch.
To our maybe our final game, we have time to talk about one last thing that is not a Ghostbusters game, but it's actually the best Ghostbusters game. But let's talk about Ghostbusters: the video game 2009 for everything, which is I have not seen the Ghostbusters reboot, Ghostbusters Answer the Call, but this is essentially Ghostbusters 3 in a way. First of all, who has played this game?
I have.
I've played it. I played it when I was unemployed, so my time was meaningless, and I enjoyed it. But
I think it's the closest thing to Ghostbusters 3 we're ever going to get.
It was really pretty. It was a good-looking game. It had a lot of development problems, and mostly due to the fact that when the Activision, like, Vivendi thing happened, it was one of the orphans, but Atari picked it up. It came out in 2009, and I remember I was actually in the industry by then, which is a little strange to say. And I remember that so Harold Ramis and Dan Aykroyd were working on it together, and they were talking about how different it was to work on a video game script versus a Hollywood script, mainly because they had to come up with lines for everything.
Yeah, they were script doctors on this game. They didn't write the whole thing, but they were consultants, and I think they were pretty hands-on. And I think this made them be less grumpy and bitter about Ghostbusters. I feel like a lot of them resented that this is their most famous thing they've done, kind of, in a way, especially Bill Murray. But even grumpy, sour Bill Murray was talking about how much he enjoyed working on this project, I think, on like David Letterman or something like that. But
it was kind of a reunion.
It was basically the last reunion that would ever happen because, unfortunately, Harold Ramis is now dead. I think he died in 2013. Yeah, he was a great comedic force in this world.
Sigourney Weaver did not come on this one, though.
And that's a funny story because later she told reporters or she told a site or something that I didn't know this was a Ghostbusters reunion. I thought they just wanted me to be Dana again. If I had known it would be everybody, I would have done it. And of course, Rick Moranis kind of retired from acting after the Flintstones movie for the most part to take care of his kids because his wife died in 1991. And he is not really that available anymore. But it was a pretty good reunion of the cast. Alyssa Milano, I'm going to say right now, not a great actor, was the new love interest. Did not play well off of 60-some-year-old Bill Murray, but they did their best, I think.
Well, it was also – it was – like supposed to take place in the early 90s, so it was a younger version of Bill Murray.
Yeah, yeah.
He's and only middle-aged.
I will say everyone performed pretty well. I will say that there are some lines where it's like, oh, you couldn't get a second take out of Bill Murray, obviously. Like he's notoriously hard to work with. He has like no agent. I've heard you call – if you want him to work on your thing, you call and leave a message on his answering machine and he might get back to you. He's very reclusive in that way, but – this is a very by-the-numbers of its time scripty third-person shooter. It is not a bad game. It's also nothing to write home about. It, in some parts, are a little annoying, but they do their best, and it is an admirable attempt to make something out of the Ghostbusters license. And there is trapping ghosts. It's like all about hunting and trapping ghosts, scanning stuff with your PKE meter like Metroid Prime, like getting a lot of lore out of the Ghostbusters universe, things like that. It's a great exploration of that world.
If you're a fan of the game, and by then, you know, a lot of us were in our 20s and 30s, those of us who grew up with Ghostbusters, like it was really great because, I mean, you had lots of cool fan servicey things. Like you were going around the Ghostbusters firehouse, which was fully rendered.
You can talk to Viggo.
Viggo was hanging out there and he was being all like snide and snarky. Like
and
he wasn't evil anymore.
It's Max von Sydow who does his lines.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Oh my God.
And
that's great.
It's all like that. Like come here, boy. I'll wear you like pets. But yeah, if you're a fan, like, this is basically the game you always wanted.
Yes, exactly. It was the game that I wanted in 1991, but of course couldn't have.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And in fact, I mean, it's very much – it very much throws you into the – like, this game is like you are hanging out with the Ghostbusters because mm-hmm. it is the protagonist is like Chrono and Chrono Trigger, yeah. like Ness and Earthbound. You are a generic person.
You are a generic white guy.
Yeah, the kid, the rookie. Although, yep. if I don't know if you guys played the Wii version ever, you could also be a generic white girl.
That's right, yeah.
Although none of the dialogue would change. They'd still address you as him.
So yeah. Oh, yeah. Man. Well, I guess you couldn't get that many extra lines out of those actors. But, yeah.
Although there are some dialogue differences. And, like, the Wii version sort of plays down some of the more suggestive bits.
I see. It's a little more family-friendly, yeah.
There are some different levels. Like, I think in the 360 PS3 one, you shoot up an architect's studio, and in the Wii one, it's like a game design studio,
oh,
and you get
okay.
like a bunch of sprite-based enemies and start flying at you. Yeah.
Yeah, I like the choice. I mean, I wish there was a female version of this in the more popular version, the better version of this game, but it's funny. They kind of excuse it where it's like – your character tries to talk sometimes is interrupted, and they don't want to learn your name because they don't want to get too attached to you because apparently they've been through rookies before who have died on the job, it seems. The rookie was actually played by the associate producer of the game, Ryan French, and I'll link to a YouTube interview with him, but it's interesting as to how he got the role. It's kind of – I would feel weird about playing the most generic white guy ever in a video game because he kind of is. He's sort of like the default white guy you would see just like walking on the streets, like the character creator white guy that has no none of the options altered on his design. So really I think the banter and the presence of the cast makes this game.
Absolutely.
It's just great to be with the Ghostbusters and hear them like joke and hear Egon be Egon, hear Ray be Ray, hear Peter be Peter, and hear Winston be Winston. Winston is given a lot more to do, I think. I think they finally do more with this character, and I think there was a conscious choice to make more of Winston. But
the actor is actually really good. I like him in a lot of different things.
Yeah, Ernie Hudson?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's great. He's really great.
I think he's missing from like the first half of the game, but then he shows up and it's like, hey guys, I was just finishing up my PhD. So.
Yeah, he's given a bit more respect, I think. So as Michael pointed out, and I think Jeremy too, there's a different version of this game with much of the same dialogue. I think it's like 95% the same and the same story, but it's the Wii, the PS2, and PSP versions are more stylized and they are kind of real Ghostbusters-ish, but not really. But Egon does have big hair at least, so I think there was some inspiration there, but they didn't or couldn't use those real Ghostbusters characters for whatever reason. I don't know why they made that choice, probably because they're working on systems with a lower power and they wanted to be more convincing and give you a better experience with what that hardware is capable of. But I haven't played these at all. Has anyone played these versions of this game at all?
I've played the Wii one a bit. And
like, how does that work with the Wiimote? Is it fun?
It's a little tough because it felt a lot more responsive and sensitive, I guess. So, you know, and pointing it at the screen is just kind of meh.
By 2009, the motion control thing wasn't quite the novelty it had been.
I'm remembering, like, I didn't actually play the Wii one. I played the PS2 one, which is identical but tries to adapt the Wii controls to PS2 and does not do such a
good
job.
There were a few games like that, like Silent Hill, Shattered Memories, things like that. They are Wii SKUs, but they also have a PS2 version, yeah.
Yeah, play it on the Wii if you can.
What an odd time to be alive. There are seven versions of this game that, yeah.
It was all different developers too. The one who made the 360 PS3 version, this is easily their best game. They're mostly known for porting like Metal Slug Anthology, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Terminal Reality.
They did a really horrible Walking Dead game, and they also did Kinect Star Wars, aww, which was really terrible.
Which gave us like Darth Vader dancing to like YMCA or something.
It no longer exists, the studio.
Yeah.
So RIP, but this is definitely their best work.
There is a unique DS game that I only watch videos of, but is a top-down game with driving sequences. It looks okay. I never played it. I probably never will, but what a weird time to be alive when there are three versions of a licensed game. It just reminds me of the 90s.
I mean, it was, you know, at this point, Ghostbusters nostalgia was definitely in full swing.
Yeah.
Because the 80s were back, baby. And,
yes. And they will never leave.
To some extent, like, the Ghostbusters nostalgia has not left us. I'd say that a lot of us are still fans of it, so.
Yeah. So we're going to move on. We have time, thank God, for the last game in our list. And so what I forgot to mention is it doesn't really matter because you can't read any of this content. But like I did on 1UP with all the Simpsons games, I wrote about every Ghostbusters game. This was my last entry. The secret best Ghostbusters game, to borrow Shane Bettenhausen terminology, that is Luigi's Mansion. It is actually the best Ghostbusters game ever made. And I'm happy that there was a lot riding on it for the GameCube's launch. It was unfairly criticized for not being a Mario platformer, but I think people have come around to realize it is a fun adventure game, sort of a parody of Resident Evil in a way.
Now that we've had a few system launches, Nintendo system launches without a Mario platformer that changes the universe, I think people are kinder to it. But you do have to keep in mind that the NES launched with Super Mario Brothers, the Super NES launched with Super Mario World, and the N64 launched with Super Mario 64. So there was this precedent here and very high expectations for a new Nintendo system launch. And this game was designed to be very modest and to provide a totally different experience. And people just weren't ready for that.
And people don't like it when Nintendo gets weird. They're like, I don't understand. This isn't Zelda.
Nintendo's at their best, actually.
Weird Nintendo, I think.
I agree. No, that's – and – but
I'm
you
just
know,
saying those people are dumb.
Yes, exactly. But the journalists were going, well, what the heck is this? I mean, this is cute and weird and kind of short, and it's not a graphical extravaganza. It's just weird.
Yeah, and actually Michael brought up on Video Game Apocalypse, which I forgot, is that this was intended to be a 3D game back when that was going to be
like
the
stereoscopic 3D.
The gimmick of the system, which is why all of the levels are like you're looking into like sort of a diorama almost. But this game was really showing off the power of the GameCube in that like lots of things moving around. You can use – it was just fun to use Luigi's vacuum on objects in the background. We should say Luigi was equipped with the Poltergust, which was his way of busting ghosts. It is so
also
explicitly
a Game Boy horror.
That's right, the Game Boy horror. But it's so explicitly a Ghostbusters ripoff. In fact, you don't have a trap, but you do suck in ghosts. And the way you do it, it feels so satisfying. And I feel bad that I never played the Dark Moon sequel.
Oh, it's really good.
And I heard it's really good. But man, I love Luigi's Mansion, and I feel like we can credit this for really personifying Luigi, like it or not, as who he is today.
You gave him the coward,
a coward weirdo.
Yeah,
You want to root for, but he's also like a giant baby.
Kind of a loser, yeah.
I want to say another Ghostbusters knockoff that I don't know if you have on the list, Ghost Hunter.
You know what? When 1UP was moving and we just had a library no one was doing anything with, I grabbed it because who knows what would happen to those games. I never got a chance to play it, but I know it's a UK-developed PS2 game. Can you talk more about it?
Yeah. I reviewed this for GMR Magazine way back in the day.
Oh,
nice. It's by Studio Cambridge, Sony Studio Cambridge, which is the same studio that did, I think, Primal.
Primal, okay.
Yeah, and it was published by Namco in the U.S. for some reason. But it's very like real Ghostbusters style shticky with like lots of like really big, disturbing, monstrous ghosts that you have to bust, and they like take you into like their different worlds. Like I think I just have this weird memory of. There's like this ghost family that like lives out on a bayou, and you have to like go into this bayou area to bust them. And like the son is this like gigantic bulbous muscle man who's like died wrestling an alligator. So now he's like always wrestling an alligator. The mother is like this villain. You like go into this room with like – she's just like her corpse sitting in a rocking chair, but it's gigantic.
Weird.
And like you don't do anything in this room. You're just sort of walking through. And it's just filled with like those really disturbing sort of set pieces. But – there's like this lightheartedness that runs through the whole thing.
And do you trap ghosts like you do in Ghostbusters?
I don't really remember. I do remember there was something like the Proton Pack where like you're sucking in ghosts and capturing them. But I don't remember. I don't think there was like a separate trap. But it has been years since I played this.
Yeah, it looks interesting. Unfortunately, I feel like We won't play a lot of these games again, especially any licensed Ghostbusters game. But Luigi's Mansion, I'm hoping, gets a re-release on Switch with their virtual console GameCube, which they're kind of hinting at. Is that true? They're saying, we might do
They've hinted at it. Who knows?
Yeah, who knows what they'll
they
do. But
will do.
I replayed it back in 2009 for that 1UP blog, and I was like, I love Luigi's Mansion. I liked it at the time. I was like, this is sort of a 10-hour experience that I paid $50 for in 2001. But it's a fun little diversion. It's like, what if Nintendo made Resident Evil / Ghostbusters? And I find it just very enchanting and a weird project they would probably not do today on that scale as a launch game.
It's definitely found its audience, and it's, you know, beloved.
I feel like Captain Toad Treasure Tracker has the same spirit as Luigi's Mansion.
A bit, yeah. I feel like it did have roots in another game, but it is a smaller release that just should have been digital and not in a box.
And was great.
It was really good, yeah. I did play through all of that. But yeah, that is our Ghostbusters episode, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us. I think we covered everything. We did not touch the extreme Ghostbusters because they're too extreme for me, frankly.
The game's not very good at it.
Yeah, and I think it's just like a Game Boy Advance game or something.
Game Boy Color.
Game Boy Color. Okay, in that case, a licensed Game Boy Color game.
I suffered through that in preparation for this
show. Oh, God. Michael, say something about it then. I mean, you sacrificed your time.
I only played like the first level. You're playing as Eduardo. You're very big and very slow, and it kind of takes a minute to get used to the controls because you're shooting this capture beam and like by hitting left and right you sort of just move it around in a circle.
I see.
And to aim it and yeah, it's like these maze-like levels where it's like you get to the end and like, oh, that's not the end. I had to do something else in here.
Huh. I don't know Extreme Ghostbusters that well. I associate it with like Sonic Underground as these garish, awful late 90s cartoons I was kind of too old for and then not for me. But I do remember Maurice LaMarche, who played Egon in the real Ghostbusters, came back to play Egon in Extreme Ghostbusters. And I was like, maybe I'll watch it for that Egon, but I couldn't even go that far.
Egon and Janine, I think, were the only returning characters. And it was like the idea was Ghostbusters, the next generation, where they have like these snarky, you know, 20-somethings.
We had some ladies. We had a guy in a wheelchair.
Yeah, Kylie, the goth girl who dressed in football pads.
Yep. Interesting. And did the new movie acknowledge the old movie at all, or was it an alternate reality? How did they even address that? Okay, yeah. I was wondering about that. But
are you talking about the Melissa McCarthy one?
Yes. I call it Answer the Call Cat. That's his actual name that everyone refers to it as.
It's a parody, and that's how it is.
And I guess we're not going to talk about Sanctum of Slime or the one that was tied in with the new movie.
I left that out. The one tied in with the new movie is too new. Sanctum of Slime looked too crappy to talk about, but we want to be thorough. If you have something to say about Sanctum of Slime, Michael, this will be the only time anyone talks about it on a podcast ever for the rest of time.
I have nothing to say about Sanctum of Slime. It
was it a dual-stick shooter?
Yeah, I think so.
The one thing I associated with is that box art where they refuse to acknowledge that there are women in the movie upon which it is based.
It's a logo. There are no women. Oh, that's like silhouettes or something?
Yeah, it's silhouettes.
Yeah, yeah. We'll talk about that in 10 years.
Or will we? Probably won't.
No, no one will. It's just weird to see a licensed game on that level, but yeah. So to wrap up for my third time, this has been the Ghostbusters episode. Thank you for joining us. This is a fun exploration. I was glad to revisit this 8 years later, not on the phone, not nervous in grad school, nervous in San Francisco. Much different experience, but let's move on to our plugs. I will go last. I want to take a break from talking. Let's move on to Kat. Kat, where can we find you?
Hi, I'm Kat Bailey. I run a little website called US Gamer where, you know, we do the usual video game thing, but we're pretty retro-friendly, so come on down if you really enjoy us. And I also host a podcast called Axe the Blood God with my co-host Nadia Oxford. We talk about RPGs of all shapes and sizes every Friday, so check us out. We're coming up on our 100th episode. Very exciting.
I'm Michael Raparez. I host a podcast called Vigigame Apocalypse, on which I am usually much less congested than I've been on this episode. Apologies for that. We just passed episode 200 a few weeks ago.
Congrats.
So that's feeling, a great landmark. Pretty
that's
happy
amazing.
About that. But, and you can also read my work for Ubisoft at ubiblog.com.
Jeremy, how about you?
I'm Jeremy Parrish, and if you go to my Twitter account at twitter.com/gamespite, I will haunt you. It will be exciting. In the meantime, you can find me here at Retronauts because that's what I do.
I will also haunt you at Wikiparas.
Yes, and you should follow me at @_catbot because pretty soon my followers will be over 9,000.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
Jeez, that's my power meter just broke.
It's Retronauts, so I need to dust off 10-year-old memes here.
Also, I should say follow Wikiparas with an AZ because the EZ is an ebook spot that someone made out of.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Those bastards. Well, you can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. I also write every day for fandom.com about video games and every other Thursday for somethingawful.com as I have for the past 12 years. And my other podcast is Talking Simpsons and Chronological Exploration of the Simpsons every Wednesday at TalkingSimpsons.com or just search for Talking Simpsons in your podcast machine. It's a great podcast. I love doing it. And we go into such excruciating detail about every joke, every reference, every interesting character move. I think it's a great exploration if you love The Simpsons. And as always, this podcast is brought to you by Patreon and all of our great Patreon listeners. Go to patreon.com/retronauts to find out how you can help us. As little as $1 a month can help us stay afloat. And we're now an official business and trying to make this a full-time thing. Jeremy has already done it. And we want to do so much more with this podcast and with all the related content. So please go to patreon.com/retronauts for more info. You can get ad-free episodes if you donate enough. You can get a t-shirt, other rewards, and you can just, you know, get as much Retronauts stuff as you want. You can always follow us on Retronauts on Twitter and Retronauts on Facebook. That is a lot of plugs, and I am out of things to say. So thank you so much for joining us this week. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Retronauts. We'll see you then.
The Mueller Report. I'm Ed Donahue with an AP News Minute. President Trump was asked at the White House if Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation report should be released next week when he will be out of town.
I guess from what I understand, that will be totally up to the Attorney General.
Maine's Susan Collins says she would vote for a congressional resolution disapproving of President Trump's emergency declaration to build a border wall, becoming the first Republican senator to publicly back it. In New York, the wounded supervisor of a police detective killed by friendly fire was among the mourners attending his funeral. Detective Brian Simonson was killed as officers started shooting at a robbery suspect last week. Commissioner James O'Neill was among the speakers today at Simonson's funeral.
It's a tremendous weight to bear, knowing that your choices will directly affect the lives of others. But cops like Brian don't shy away from it. It's the very foundation of who they are and what they do.
The robbery suspect and a man police say acted as his lookout have been charged with murder. I'm Ed Donahue.